You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Uncover the twisted tales that inspired the big screen's greatest screams. Which case of demonic possession inspired The Exorcist? What horrifying front page story generated the idea for A Nightmare on Elm Street? Which film was based on the infamous skin-wearing murderer, Ed Gein? Unearth the terrifying and true tales behind some of the scariest horror movies to ever haunt our screens, including the Enfield poltergeist case that was retold in The Conjuring 2 and the serial killers who inspired Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. Behind the Horror dissects these and other bizarre tales to reveal haunting real-life stories of abduction, disappearance, murder, and exorcism. The book that we're featuring this evening is Behind the Horror, True Stories That Inspired Horror Movies, with my special guest, journalist, author, and podcaster, Dr. Lee Meller. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Dr. Lee Meller.
Hey, Dan. It's been so long. Well, I can't remember the last time. I'm so thrilled to be back on the show.
It's a big thrill for me to have you, since you're a very, very busy man writing and now with the fantastic podcast, Murder Was the Case. Let's talk about just what is covered in this book, Behind the Horror. If you'd like, just we could go through each of the chapters that you have, and then you could just make a comment about it. We could discuss it briefly, because there are so many stories in this collection. So
yeah, that'd be great. And I mean, I think the book came out a few months ago, and I had all of the chapters, all the details memorized, but you know, after a few months it starts to fade a little bit. So I think a broader approach would probably work better. Yeah,
absolutely. You also just talk at the beginning a little bit about just movie makers deciding to, well, not deciding to be inspired, but certainly they were inspired by real life murders and bizarre crimes and strange crimes that are covered in Behind the Horror. Just tell us a little bit about just the very beginning of filmmaking, because obviously filmmakers are influenced by other filmmakers. So you talk about Fritz Lang, 1931, and M, and just talk about just a little bit of the true history that was that inspired filmmaker Fritz
okay.
Lang.
Okay. Yeah, so M was a film that was made by Fritz Lang and released in Weimar, Germany. That is the period of the German Republic between the two world wars. It was about 2 years before Hitler's rise to power. And during this period, there was a lot of problems which kind of paved the way for the Nazis. There was like hyperinflation. There was a lot of poverty. And there was also a strange boom in serial murder. And this did not go unnoticed to the police and the citizenry in Germany at the time. Now, they didn't have a name for it. It wasn't until around this time, about 1931, the same year that M came out, that Ernst Gnat, who was like the director of the Berlin police, came up with the term Syrian Mord for serial murder. So it was the first time it was really named, and so we can talk about some of those murderers that were in Weimar, Germany. Some of them, there's a lot more information than others, but some of them are really, truly grotesque cases. Like even by today's standards, they still hold up as being really foul.
Absolutely, yeah, and some of them are now again involved with sort of the golden age of serial killing. At least these are regarded as some of the biggest and biggest names in serial killing, and certainly in true crime these days.
Yeah, and you'll see references going back to particularly the one that I was able to find the most information about and wrote the most about was the Vampire of Dusseldorf, Peter Curtin. Mm-hmm. But he's also kind of the last in the chronology. So just to begin, you have a guy who was known mostly as Stump Arm, and his name was Johann Meyer. And there's not a hell of a lot to talk about with him, just the case itself seemed to be mainly shooting people. And he would do weird things, like he killed two men, and then he would decapitate them, and he would swap their heads, for instance.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So this was going on more around the very end of the First World War. He's not a particularly interesting one, but I gave him like a couple pages just to show where it all began. Then you have a guy, Frederick Schumann, the terror of Falkenhagen Lake. And he was, I think, probably highly psychopathic. He was one of these criminals that he was very diverse, and he would prey on people in lovers' lanes, kill the males, and then rape and murder their female partners in a much more sadistic way. And he would do things, too, like just shoot people driving along the Autobahn just for a thrill. So those are probably the two of the lesser-known ones. When we get to Carl Grossman, and this is now into the 1920s, he's known as the Butcher of Berlin. And Grossman ran a sausage stand at a train station. I can't recall it off the top of my head, but it was a very busy train station in Germany. And essentially, people would just come by, and they loved his plump, juicy sausages and the special flavor that they had. And these significantly improved at one point in time. And because I guess at the time, because there were food shortages in Germany, they would pad out the sausages with things like turnips and all kinds of other fillers. But they noted at some point that his sausages became particularly meaty. And they would buy them, and they'd be in a rush, so nobody really paid him much attention. They'd just get the famous sausages, get on the train, and go where they needed to be going. Well, the reason the sausages got so much more juicy was because Carl Grossman, having spent so much time around the station, he knew that there were people coming in from the provinces, so from the countryside, and they were looking for work in Berlin. As I said, this was a time of great economic downturn. It was the Depression. And that these people, they didn't know the city, and they were desperate and looking for work. And he would select young women and try and make it seem like a coincidence, like, why are you here? Can I help you? Well, I'm looking for work, you know, maybe as a serving girl or something. Oh my, I can't believe this. What luck.
Yeah.
Could you imagine? Yeah. I am actually on my way to the employment office right now looking for a serving girl, and here I have found one. Do you want to take the job? Well, of course they do. And they must have felt very fortunate themselves. They just step off the train into Berlin, and they've already found employment doing what they want, except that's the ruse. And he brings them back to his apartment, and he rapes them and seems to have sadistically tortured them. And then he kills and butchers them, and he makes them into sausage meat. So it's like you've got the victims arriving at the station, being processed at his apartment, and then being returned to the station and sold to passengers who are either getting off the train or getting onto the train. So
incredible.
That in itself was just a complete grisly case. Yeah. It reminds me, you know, we see kind of modern iterations of that, like in the Robert Picton case in Canada, right? Where he didn't exactly feed the remains to his neighbors, but he fed them to the pigs, and
close.
Then so yeah, it's close enough. It's like cannibalism by proxy, right? And so this obviously just horrified a lot of people, and I don't think that you could just forget that. I mean, even if you lived to the ripe old age of 80 and through the horrors of the war that were to come, you would always remember the time that you ate the sausage that was probably made from a young woman who had stepped off a train, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And as well as it doesn't end with that too, because it almost like he's inspired. There's a Fritz Haarmann. Tell us a little about Fritz Haarmann.
Yeah, Fritz Haarmann was in Hanover, so that's further to the west, and a little later than Carl Grossman, but also known as a butcher and the werewolf of Hanover. And Fritz Haarmann, once again, very similar MO. Good pickup on that, Dan. A lot of young men coming into Hanover on trains, looking for opportunities, and there he is, and he has an accomplice who is his lover. I think his, Hans Granz, if I remember that correctly. And they would lure these young men back to his apartment, and he would bite through their windpipe. I think sometimes they might have been drunk or asleep, but he would actually kill them by biting through their windpipe. And then he would dismember them, and he would dump the bodies into the river. And there was some pretty strong evidence that he was also selling the meat too. The interesting thing about Haarmann is that he was also a police informant, which is something that I've seen in modern serial killers or criminals. Like, you get like Whitey Bulger, right? Or Scott Lee Kimball. You hear these cases and you go, how can this person be a police informant and be a serial killer at the same time? Well, it's nothing new. This goes back to Fritz Haarmann, at least, in Weimar, Germany. And so, I mean, they think he killed about 25 people. Grossman, it may have been as little as maybe 4 or 6, but it could have been high. But yeah, Haarmann, almost certainly like at least 25. And so this is when they start to really notice this. I mean, Grossman is in Berlin. Haarmann is in Hanover. I mean, these are major cities, and so it's making it into the press. And I think at this time, Ernst Gannat, who coined Surienmord, and probably Fritz Lang are starting to pick up on it more. The final one, of course, is Peter Curtin, the Vampire of Dusseldorf. And Peter Curtin is a hematolanist. That's someone who is sexually aroused by the sight of blood, and also a sexual vampire. And he gets off in drinking blood, and a sexual sadist, in that he gets off in causing harm. So he has a whole array of paraphilia, but mainly centering around blood. And over a very long career, starting in the 20s, but going into the 30s, and targeting mainly females, but I think there was a few male victims in there too, but the age ranges went from being little girls all the way up to being middle-aged women. Peter Curtin is basically, there was a few home invasions, but he's stalking them through the streets, and he might club them over the head with a hammer or stab them to death, and then he will masturbate at the, looking at their blood, or in some cases drinking their blood. And on at least one occasion that I can recall, he had sex with the dead body. So when you put this all together, like, we, even in this time right now, we can't think of five serial killers that really are that standout in this day and age. As you said, the golden age, in quotation marks, has kind of passed. But if you just go to this one period in Weimar, Germany, you have this deluge of sexual, violent depravity, and people are just going, what is going on? And suddenly Ernst Gannat coins the term Surienmord for it. By the way, he was the one that investigated several of these cases. And so Fritz Lang, this filmmaker, is watching this, and it inspires him to make M, City Searches for a Murderer, in 1931, starring the great Peter Lorre, who plays basically a child murderer. And they don't get into the details too much about what he did. I mean, back then, they had to be careful with that, right? But from a cinematic point of view, it's beautifully shot. As a narrative, it's in German. It's got subtitles. It's dated a bit. You have to be a very patient film watcher. But just seeing the photography and the performance by Peter Lorre, and then if you're able to go back to that period and put yourself in what it would have been like to see a film like that back in 1931, you realize this is like one of the masterpieces of cinema, like a Citizen Kane, basically.
You and also arguably, talk about... Sorry, go ahead.
One of the first... that is my fault. I paused and then went to add, because also arguably one of the first thrillers.
Yes. Also, too, that it had gone... Not suddenly, but it had gone by 1931 from a depiction of mindless evil to a psychological drama. So it really was a leap in sort of an protagonist depiction in movies, certainly.
Yeah, well, that's it. So the villain in M, who's portrayed by Peter Lorre, by no means do you like him. I mean, this is a child killer, a serial child killer. But there's this classic scene where the police start to increase their presence and they start to come down on criminal elements in the city because these murders are so high profile. And they're like, we've got to crack down. It's got to be one of these criminals, you know. So increase... basically the police interference into the day-to-day lives of criminals and we'll find this miscreant. And so for all the organized crime bosses in the city at this time, this is really bad for business. And so then they join in and they're like, if we can get rid of this child murderer too, then the police are going to back off and we can make as much money as we were before. Once again, this is during the Depression and there were black markets and things to profit from. And so now he's not only got the police coming after him, but he's got the criminals, and it's the criminals, the organized gangsters that find him. And they, at the end of the movie, they bring him before this kangaroo court. And the expression on Peter Lorre's face, he's so emotive, and you can see he's genuinely panicked. And he knows that though they're going to give him a trial, it's not a real trial. And they're going to end up killing him anyway. And he says, and I'm paraphrasing here, who are you to accuse me? Like, you do this because you profit. For you, it's a choice. For me, I just can't help myself. And that's when he breaks down, that famous scene where he's weeping into his hands. I just can't help myself. And it's an interesting, as you said, it breaks the black and white there, because there is something of a point in that. He's driven by this intersexual compulsion, which leads him to do immoral things. And yes, he chooses to do that, but the strain on him psychologically to commit these acts of murder versus the choices that these other criminals make, which almost certainly involve murder at some point if you're in organized crime, right? He's saying that, you know, you make me out to be a monster, but I'm driven by what BTK or someone would call factor X, right? Like, I was born this way, and you guys choose it, and you point the finger at me. And so... don't take that as a defense of the serial child killer, but it's that sometimes I think we tend to glorify organized criminals, right? We tend to think of them as, oh, they're not as bad, even though they can be responsible for many more deaths, and they're doing it for much shallower reasons psychologically, you know? Right. So absolutely astute observation there, Dan. And that's the masterpiece of the film. And it took a lot of balls, I think, to have that kind of gray approach at that time.
Certainly, certainly. Let's use it as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, Lee, you talk about the next book that you, or pardon me, the next movie you touch on is The Murder of Bobby Franks. And so this is a real life murder of Bobby Franks, and the movie is Rope by Alfred Hitchcock. So Tell us just briefly about the inspiration, the real life inspiration for this movie.
The inspiration for the movie was based on the crimes of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb in Chicago. And this goes back to, I think it was the 1920s. It was the mid-20s. And at the time, it was called the crime of the century. And like when you hear it, it's a bad crime, but it's, they had a lot of hyperbole back then. Everything was the crime of the century. So Leopold and Loeb are these two people of genius IQ or around it, and they come from privileged upbringings, and they're attending the best schools. And Loeb is more of a criminal. Yeah, he gets off on transgression. He's more charismatic. He makes friends more easily. And Leopold, his counterpart, not so much. He's more of a removed intellectual. He's awkward, and he's also homosexual. And he really craves Loeb. So you have a folie à deux situation that happens here where you have Loeb going, you know, we should commit crime because it's thrilling and it's fun. And you have Leopold, who knows that if he helps Loeb with the crimes, that Loeb will engage in sexual relations with him. So Loeb uses his sexual, the fact that Leopold is sexually attracted to him as like a carrot that he dangles. And of course, with Loeb being Loeb, it's enough to just say committing crime is fun. But with Leopold, because he is, and he did have a really high IQ, as a very learned young man, he had to justify it in some way. So he used, I would say, a total misreading of Friedrich Nietzsche's idea of the Übermensch. And that was the way that he was able to justify doing this, is that saying, hey, we are so intelligent and we are so rich and we are so much more transcendent than other people that we can commit murder and like have almost a right to do it because we're part of this elite and we are beyond man, Übermensch. I won't get into what Nietzsche actually meant by that. It was something a lot more, in my mind, benevolent. But he uses it to justify it. And, you know, they go from thefts to, you know, breaking and enterings and such. But with these types of criminals, at some point, the thrill is gone, to quote B.B. King. And they decide, you know, what would be the ultimate thrill would be to commit a murder. And so they meticulously plan this murder, you know, how they're going to rent the car, where they're going to dump the body, how they're going to do it. They overplan it in many ways, which was, I was just having a conversation about this with Catherine Ramsland the other day about how you can actually overplan a murder because then you don't really adjust for all of the variables that can go wrong, right? Wow. And they scour a neighborhood looking for a victim to abduct, and they find Bobby Franks, who was about 14 years old at the time. He was a young man, and he was, I think, a cousin of Loeb. He was related to him. And Bobby's walking home from school, and they're like, hey, we'll give you a ride. He's like, I don't need a ride. I'm almost home. No, hop in, Bobby. We'll give you a ride. He gets in the car, and they use a chisel to kill him. I think they may have also strangled him with a length of rope. They drive his body out to the pre-selected place in the countryside, and they put him in like a culvert, and then they drive back, and they go through all the stages of their plan. They call his family, and they put in a fake ransom demand all to stage it and make it look like something else has happened, except Leopold drops his prescription glasses at the crime scene. So this is this criminal genius, right? Despite all his planning, he loses his glasses at the crime scene. And this is before mass manufacturing, right? And him being so rich, they're very easily able to trace where these glasses, you know, where the lenses were, who they were made for, who in Chicago imports these types of frames. And eventually it's traced back to Leopold and Loeb. And so these criminal geniuses are caught, and they stand trial in court and are convicted. Leopold eventually gets out and seems to live a fairly normal life in his old age and dies. I think Loeb dies in prison. But this inspired a play called Rope, in which two young men basically conspire to kill a former classmate and then hide him in a trunk and then invite over his fiance and his parents and this university professor who always talked about moral relativism, and that it would be like this great piece of art. You know, it would be a joke that was also artistic, homicidal performance art in a way, to have them all over and to put out like a buffet spread over this trunk. And they would be in on it. You know, we've just strangled this guy and put him in this trunk, and everyone's eating off it and they have no idea. And all the time they're asking, when's he going to show up? Because he's supposed to be at the dinner party too. Well, Hitchcock liked this play, and he made it into his 1948 film Rope, which is probably most notable because it was not only Hitchcock's first Technicolor film, but it was also a film which seems to have almost zero cuts, which if you think of even a film today, there's copious editing. Like, this is one of my complaints about modern cinema. It's gotten a little bit better, but especially from 2000s to like 2010, it was just cut all the time. The cuts are unnecessary. Why are you doing this? Just because you didn't film the scene right? And here's Hitchcock. He doesn't even have the technology. He does the entirety of the film in what appears to be a single cut. So there's never an editing take. But there's a trick to it, Dan. Do you know the trick?
No.
So what he does, because it was actually impossible to do it with the technology, is that he will pan the camera away for a moment so that the screen is blocked out by a cabinet momentarily. And then because the screen is blacked out, he could then switch the camera up, put new film in, start filming from the exact same spot, and then pan back out. So it appears that it hasn't cut when it actually has.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, it's like watching a really good play, and Jimmy Stewart's in it, and once again, more of a thriller, but the story behind it is fantastic, and all of, I would say most of these films I would recommend people watch if they haven't seen them.
Absolutely. We're going to try to talk about some of these and a little bit more specifics a little bit, but people are pretty familiar with Psycho from 1960, obviously, Norman Bates. Mm-hmm. And also they're very, very familiar with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And also people have talked about the connections or the inspiration being Ed Gein and his crimes in Wisconsin. What I wanted to talk about was about Frenzy from 1972 and the crimes of John Christie and Neville Heath, and the Hammersmith nude murders. Talk about a little bit about Frenzy from 1972 and the crimes that inspired and the killers that inspired this movie.
Yeah, so sure. Frenzy was, I believe, Hitchcock's second last film, and it was the last film he ever did in England. And it was a return after he had made some forays into espionage films that received mixed reviews. It was his return back to this sort of serial killer thriller genre, which I tackle a lot of those films in the book. And by that time, so it's 1972, he's had a whole lot of murder. Keep in mind, Hitchcock is English. So there's a lot of murder in Britain over that period of time. And the case that it most obviously resembles was, let's say, about slightly less than a decade old at the time that Frenzy comes out. And that's the Hammersmith nude murders, where you have somewhere in the realm of between 6 and 8 prostitutes in London who are murdered. They're usually found strangled or drowned. Many of them are floating in the Thames. And the unknown killer was dubbed Jack the Stripper by the press, obviously as an homage to the earlier Jack the Ripper, but because he always stripped the victims. And so this has never been solved. There's a lot of people that they strongly believe did it. The police have one of those things where they say, look, we know the guy who did it. We didn't get enough evidence, but he killed himself. For all intents and purposes, it's closed. But officially, this case has never been solved. And so that was going on in the swinging 60s in London. And Frenzy starts off where there are a group of people gathered by the Thames River, and somebody's talking about some sort of environmental project, you know, beautifying the river again or the surrounding community. And then a nude body with a necktie wrapped around its neck of a young woman comes floating into the scene, and everyone screams and they say, it's the necktie killer. He's done another one. So, you know, thus implying there's a serial killer at large. Right. So that's the case that people have noticed the most, and Hitchcock himself confirmed inspired Frenzy. But there are parts of other serial killers in there. So the guy who plays the man who turns out to be the eventual necktie killer, the actor, Alfred Hitchcock approached him and he said, in order to understand the type of man you're playing, I want you to read this book on Neville Heath. Neville Heath is a really fascinating serial killer. Now, he only killed 2 victims to our knowledge, but he was almost like a Ted Bundy-like figure in that he was extraordinarily charming. I would say he'd make Bundy look completely like a wallflower. He was such a dashing, charming guy. And he was also a total con man. So imagine this blonde, square-jawed, very athletic fellow, and he's going around London, and he has actually been a pilot, but what he doesn't tell is, you know, he was a pilot in the RAF, but he leaves out all the parts of him getting into so much trouble in the military and all of the people he's conned. He's, once again, he's a consummate psychopath, and he's always in the pub. This guy can drink, like, it's ridiculous when I had heard how much this guy was drinking when he was committing his murders. We're talking, you know, something like 24 pints or, you know, and it's seemingly not affecting him. Just as an aside, I've heard that about quite a few serial killers. And so I don't even know if he was using his real name at the time, but he had a reputation around the pub as, you know, the dashing, handsome RAF pilot. And this would have been just after the Second World War. And he's always buying drinks for people, and he's telling tall tales and stories, and everyone likes him. And he's also into S&M. And because he's such an attractive man and he's able to pick up the ladies fairly easily, he has no problem finding partners to engage in S&M with. And on this one particular night, whether this was planned or not, I guess we don't know, but he meets up with somebody who he's had a sadomasochistic relationship before with in the past. And he brings her back to this hotel, and they go through all the consensual stuff. You know, she allows herself to be tied up, and he pulls out a riding crop and he begins to whip her. I believe he has her gagged too, so that they can't hear the screams. And she might have consented to that as well. You know, it's all the thing about the whole BDSM thing is there's a lot of role play involved. There's an sure. idea that there are limits. You know, you've obviously probably sure. discussed safe words and stuff on the show, Dan. But Heath is, whether it's the drink or, you know, disinhibiting him, or he planned to do this all along, he just goes overboard. He gets into a frenzy. He basically whips this woman to death with a riding crop and puts a pillow over her face, and then also thrust a poker from the fireplace into her vagina, and then he escapes. And the next day, the cleaning lady tries to enter, and management gets involved, and that's when they discover the body, and they're like, oh, wow. And so the police put out this description. They're looking for this guy. By this time, Heath has made his way to another part of England. He's staying with another lover, and his name is in the paper, is about to be in the paper, but he gets ahead of it, and he tells her, hey, you know, this, I can't remember how he spins it. He gets her to believe that he was framed or it was an accident or something like that. And then he gets out of town before things really blow up. And he kind of disappears. And he makes his way to a portside city. I think it was Bournemouth. That's what's coming to mind.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And he, under a different name and a different identity, you know, keep in mind there wasn't television at the time broadcasting the face everywhere. So you might have heard the name in the paper or whatever, but it's not going to be as easily identifiable as it is today. And so he's at this hotel. He's playing the whole captain whatever war hero thing again, and he's taking tea and he's charming everyone. And eventually he hooks up with his second female victim, and he invites her back to the hotel to have dinner with him. And Wong gets the impression that she knew there was something up about him. There's something about him that she didn't like. And he insists on walking her home. And at that point she goes missing. And it isn't until sometime later that they find her body. She's been eviscerated and she's been hidden in like some bushes and a briar patch or something like that in the countryside. And they realize that he would have been walking this way. It's one of the potential routes to take her home. And at this point, he comes under police scrutiny and he tries to bullshit his way out of it. But at the end of the day, they find out it's Neville Heath and he hangs for it. And he was known by, I think it was Albert Pierpoint that hung him. Albert Pierpoint probably being the most famous hangman in British history. He said, he was the most handsome man I ever hanged.
Yeah.
And so that, maybe not the crimes, but the presentation and the affect and the ability to have like a personality that the world sees, and then your secret hidden personality. Hitchcock told the actor, I think his name was Barry, I don't remember, Barry something. He told the actor, read this book on Neville Heath. And that's, I think, what was brought to the table. Not so much Heath's crimes, but Heath as a person committing crimes that were more like the Hammersmith nude murders. And the interesting thing is where the last crimes come in was based on John Christie. Yeah. Now, the John Christie case. Have you covered that one, Dan?
A little bit, yeah. But I think it warrants bringing it up again because of the diabolical nature of, you know, that he possessed. I mean, compared to, anyone, basically. Just tell us a little bit about the the abortion offer that he made to the couple. And that's an incredible story that's worth repeating, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So just to cover John Christie, I'll try and get in like three sentences. We're talking about a guy who is a high anxiety, psychopathic. He is like a hypochondriac. He speaks in this sort of hushed voice because he believes that he was actually suffered mustard gas in the First World War, but he believes that it made him talk this way when all the doctors are really saying it's psychosomatic. It didn't actually do that to him. So this was a guy who was very anxious, very hypochondriac. And this also manifests in his relationships with women from a young age. When he was a teenager, he had a chance to get laid. And for whatever reason, he couldn't get it up. And the girl told everyone, the whole town laughed at him and shamed him. And they called him Can't Make It Christy and Reggie No Dick. This is before he'd done anything really bad. And I do actually have some compassion for that, because you can imagine at the time there's no Viagra, right? There's no way to fix the situation. And so it becomes, whether it would have been just a one-time thing if he had just been left alone, or, whether it was going to be chronic anyways. He suffers from chronic impotence his whole life. He has a marriage of convenience with a woman called Ethel, who he later kills. And they don't really have a sex life. They don't have any kids. And they move to 10 Rillington Place in Notting Hill. And Christie, in total, he kills at least 8 people. And he uses various ruses. Generally, he'll knock them out using gas. And then he'll strangle them with a rope or with a tie. So there's your necktie connection again. And then he will rape them while they're either unconscious, but also some of them seem to have been kept in the home. This was after he killed his wife, kept in the home, and raped after death. So he was a necrophile. Now, in the middle of all this, upstairs, there's a couple called Timothy and Beryl Evans. Timothy Evans is Welsh. He's working class. He's from a mining town. And he's known as a guy, once again, he tells tall tales. He likes to drink a lot, and he's got a short temper. He's barely literate, and he's kind of married above his station to Beryl Evans, who is this beautiful young lady, and they have to rent this grubby flat. It was infamously, ridden by bed bugs. It was in a bad part of town, not so much for crime, but just poverty. And he's always conscious that he's not giving her the life that really is deserved of a woman of her station. And they have a lot of domestic altercations. And it doesn't seem like he was a wife beater, at least not chronically, but there was a lot of turbulence in that household. And to escape it, Timothy always goes down to the pub and drinks, where he tells his stories, that nobody believes, to his pub friends. And it's just a tumultuous relationship. And so what happens is they're already struggling with their one child, Geraldine, who is, I think, something like just over a year old at the time. And they find out that Beryl's pregnant again. Well, this is an issue because Beryl doesn't want to have the baby. First of all, she's not a very good mother. Not in the sense that she doesn't love her kids, but she's just not maternal. She's not cut out for it, really. So she didn't have that really natural instinct. But she knows also that they can't really afford it. And Timothy knows that, too. But Tim is, I can't remember if he's a Catholic or not, but, he's not for abortion. He thinks that it's wrong to do. And she's like, I want an abortion. He's saying, you can't, it's wrong. We'll deal with it. And this just leads to more and more of a storm upstairs. Well, of course, creepy Mr. Christie and his wife are downstairs. The walls are paper thin. They can hear every single thing that's going on. they know all about what's going on in their life. Of course, he pretends not to because he's a manipulative, psychopathic serial killer. And one day, Beryl's coming down the stairs, and Mr. Christie comes out, and his gasped, unthreatening voice, he says, you know, I've heard about, you know, you're having problems, you know, what's going on? And she confides in him things that he probably already knows, right? And she says, I'm pregnant again, and I want to have an abortion. And he says, well, I don't know if you know about this, but, you know, I have medical training, and I know how to do such a procedure. And so for her, it's like, wow, my neighbor downstairs can do this. And, of course, abortion is illegal at the time.
Right.
So either way, she's got to go to a back alley abortionist. So trusting the nice old man downstairs doesn't, you know, it seems like the most rational choice. There is no option to go to a medical professional who's certified at this procedure. And so she basically tells Tim, look, Mr. Christie's going to do the abortion. And Tim's like, no, he's not. And she's like, well, he is. And eventually she wins, and he just kind of throws up his hands, and he goes off to work. And this is when the procedure is supposed to happen. And Christie warns him, you know, sometimes these things go wrong, but it should be okay. And when you come back, this is what you should expect. Well, when he comes back, Christie meets him as he's coming up the stairs, and he says, you know, Tim, come up to the apartment, to your apartment. There's something we must discuss. And there's Beryl, and she's dead on the bed. And baby Geraldine, if I remember correctly, is still alive at this point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he says the procedure went wrong. Yeah, I think he might have said it went septic or something like that, and she's died. You know, we always said that this was a possibility. And what had really happened was that Christie had drugged and raped her and strangled her, just like he did with his other victims. He'd probably been coveting her, like this attractive woman, for so long. But because Tim is, first of all, he knows he's complicit in an illegal act. And in an illegal act, he's low IQ, he's pretty gullible, and he's getting played by a master manipulator. And Christie says, you know, we'll take care of this. We'll find someone to foster baby Geraldine out. You can go back to Wales. I'll hide the body, and no one will be any the wiser. And Timothy Evans, it seems, because he contradicts himself a lot later, seems to go along with this plot. I guess if he's rationalizing it, he's probably thinking it's the lesser of two evils, right? And so he does. He leaves and he goes to Wales. And eventually they start, he's staying with family in Wales, and he's telling them stories about how Beryl has gone to visit family on another side of England. And then Beryl's family are getting concerned, and they're attempting to look into it. And Christie's being weird with them, and he's saying, oh, Beryl just went to another part of England. And but they're thinking, well, why would she do that without telling us? And where did Timothy go? So Timothy Evans eventually makes his way back to London. And the way it ultimately plays out is that the police discover Beryl's body and that of baby Geraldine, let's keep in mind, Timothy Evans didn't know was dead. He thought she'd been fostered out, and they've both been strangled, and they're in like a wash house on the property. At least Beryl was. Geraldine might have been somewhere else, but they're in pretty close proximity. And so the police are going, okay, well, who's the likely suspect here? Who did it? And it's always the husband, right? And there is a slight grain of truth to that, and that he knew about it a bit. And Evans is then taken into custody, and you have your classic low IQ, confesses to a you know, under police pressure, enough of it, confesses to a crime that he didn't do, and is, you know, then standing trial. Well, by the time he's at trial, he's yelling, it wasn't me, you know, Christie done it, Christie done it. And Christie is actually a witness at his trial. And he's just completely lying about the situation. And, oh, I always heard them fighting, and I worried something like this would happen. And Timothy Evans hangs. And John Christie, who did actually come under some scrutiny in court, just walks out of there and goes back to living with Ethel at 10 Rillington Place. And so he's just completely destroyed this family. And sometime after, he kills his wife, Ethel. And I think he mainly does this because she's an impediment to what he wants to do. And he needs his own space to do that. And she's in his space. So she needs to go. So he kills her, puts her under the floorboards. Then he starts inviting, I think they were mainly prostitutes, back to the flat. And, you know, doing his strangling them unconscious, maybe using the gas, and then keeping them in an alcove and using their bodies over and over for the necrophilic intercourse. He eventually decides to move, and he puts wallpaper over the alcove so it doesn't even appear that there is one, and he just sort of flees without paying his rent. So by this time, there's been a lot of social changes in England, and you've got like a West Indian population coming in. So people from Jamaica, you know, particularly, and Christie and his wife are racist. They were always unhappy with the fact that all these Jamaican blacks are moving into the neighborhood, and they didn't hide that. And so this guy, Beresford Brown, he buys 10 Rillington Place, the apartment building. And he starts to move in these Jamaican families. Actually, maybe one of the families that came in was Beresford Brown. But the point is, there's a Jamaican landlord, there's Jamaican tenants. And they're up in, I think it's the Evans's apartment, this one Jamaican tenant. And he asked the landlord, he says, you know, I don't have access to, it was something like a kitchen to, you know, to cook my cuisine with upstairs, and the stove doesn't work or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. He says, do you mind if I use the abandoned place downstairs? And the guy goes, ah, go ahead. You know, I haven't rented it out yet. And so he goes down there and he starts sort of looking around, and he realizes that, wait, this one section of wall isn't wall. It's just wallpaper. And then when he pokes through it, you know, he brings this to the landlord's attention, that's when they find the initial bodies. And then the police are on the scene, and they're like, well, sorry, who was the tenant here? And, well, his name was John Reginald Halliday Christie. Oh, remember him? John Christie, the guy upstairs with the neighbor and on trial? Oh, my God. And then Christie becomes a fugitive. His name is splashed all over the newspapers, and he's hanging around London. He's living destitute, and ultimately he's caught, and he also hangs. But where this is important, playing into Frenzy by Hitchcock, is that the serial killer, the necktie killer, Bob Rusk, in Frenzy, sets up his friend, the protagonist, Dick Blaney, because Rust kills Blaney's wife and kills his girlfriend, and he sets him up for it, which is, I mean, beyond that, you might not say it's similar. They also reference Christie in, you know, the line is, we haven't had a good sex murder around these parts since Christie. But here's the thing, too, the character of Richard Blaney is very much like Timothy Evans. His IQ is higher, but he's a drunk. He's short-tempered. People see him yelling at his wife. So all of these things that were used as aggravating factors or evidence, whatever you want to call them, against Timothy Evans, you find them in the character of Dick Blaney. So you have this amazing fusion of these three disparate serial killer stories, all of which transpired in London, coming together in Hitchcock's Frenzy. And you can read in far greater detail about all those in Behind the Horror. Yeah.
Let's stop for a second for these messages. Now, what's interesting is, and I've just read a little bit about this, but you cover this extensively in your book, and you discuss The Exorcist, of course, the incredible movie, 1973, with the possession of Roland Doe. We don't have time to go too much into it, but for those people that might have thought that The Exorcist was just dreamed up completely, this does have a foundation in truth, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So the main difference is, like, as you said, Roland Doe, his last name isn't actually Doe. This was all kept top secret by the Catholic Church, and so it's like a Jane Doe. We don't even know that his first name was Roland, but essentially in the late 40s in Maryland, Roland Doe is 13 years old, and he's living there with his parents and in this house, and he has an Aunt Hattie, and Aunt Hattie is into the occult, introduces him to things like Ouija boards and the like, and then Aunt Hattie dies, and it's pretty sad for him because he doesn't have many other friends, and he misses his aunt. And shortly after this, many of the things that you see in The Exorcist begin to happen to Roland. So he'll be on his bed, and his bed will start to shake in this strange way, and he'll talk in tongues, and there will be words that seem to appear in his skin. And the parents, they don't know what to make of this, so they go to their, I think they were Lutheran, and they go to their local Lutheran reverend, Reverend Schultz, and he says, okay, well, let him come stay at my house, and we'll see how this works out. Well, he's at Reverend Schultz's house for a very short period of time, and before the exact same thing starts happening there. So now it's not only the family that's seeing all of this paranormal phenomena happening, but it's also their reverend, and they're seeing things like vibrating beds and crockery flying all over the place and furniture moving. So it's pretty intense, and you can imagine how they're scared. And at some point the reverend goes, you know, I'm not really equipped to handle this. Maybe this is more in the domain of the Catholic Church, which from a Lutheran is a pretty bold statement.
Sure.
So they, you know the history, right? So behind, so they turn basically Roland over to this Catholic Church, and they take him into a hospital, which is run by Jesuits. And the same thing happens. You know, the behavior continues to escalate, most of which you see in the film The Exorcist. And at some point they realize that they can't handle this. They're going to have to move him to this. He's got family in Missouri, where there is also another Jesuit hospital, and that they're going to have to, you know, move him down there. So they move him into this house with his family in Missouri so that some of the Jesuit priests down there can come in. And at this point they're like, he's possessed, we're going to do an exorcism. So they start going through all these esoteric rituals. You know, it's very rare that an exorcism is actually sanctioned. So this is one of the cases where it was. So obviously he's displaying the pretty convincing signs, and these priests are trying. He's exhausting them. They're coming there in the morning, and they're staying there late into the night, and sometimes he'll be asleep, but then when he's awake, he's, you know, the bed is vibrating, he's talking in tongues, the messages are appearing on his skin, and all kinds of weird phenomena. And they end up at some point bringing him to this this hospital, which is run by Jesuits. Now, during this process, if you were to believe the story, because the thing is that the Catholic Church kept a lid on this. They kept all this really secret and tightly sealed for a while, until finally somebody wrote a book on it, and they got some people to talk. So what we know about it and what actually happened. They may not be exact, but this is how it seems to have ended, where at some point the entity, the demon or whatever that possessed Roland, gave a hint, something like, if you are able to say, if you know my name, then I will leave the boy's body. And for a while, it's like they missed the clue, you know, it gets lost in the sauce because there's, it's the entity is saying so much, or perhaps they don't know what the name is and they have to figure it out. But if you were to believe the tale, they're in the Jesuit hospital. This one day things are getting particularly intense and the priest figures it out and he says, then your name is this. And then some other rituals follow. And after that, the demon has been exorcised from Roland. And then he disappears from history. And everything is closely guarded secret until the secret starts to leak out in the form of the original book about this case. But if you look into how professional skeptics have interpreted this, there's a lot of information that is left out of those sources. And believe it or not, it's fairly convincing that Roland Doe may have been just a very disturbed kid who was pulling one over on not only his family and his minister, but on all of these priests too. And there were times where they saw him doing things like cutting things into his own skin. And they never thought, maybe we're being fooled here. It was like that piece of information didn't actually enter. I think there was a lot of confirmation bias going on. So you think of a bed shaking, right? You think, well, that must be a demonic force. But then try it, right? Like, get onto an old bed that's not very sturdy and oscillate your body a little bit. And it's possible to do those things. Speaking in tongues is easy. I'll do it right now. Egoth minar nihar haralas Christo dominus thai. You know what I mean? That's so. It's whether you believe or are skeptical. There is a very good argument to be made too that this kid pulled one over on all these people. And I'll just add that the story that inspired Poltergeist also involved a teenage male, Jimmy, as a central character in that. And right. He seems to have done the same thing with the house being haunted, not him being possessed, but he fooled parapsychologists. I don't think that's a big achievement, but he fooled the police, he fooled his family. You know, the interesting thing about that case is there was a famous magician, as in like a conjurer, a stage magician, who heard about this case. It was going on in Long Island, New York, and it was 1958. Milburn Christopher, I think, was his name. And he said, can I come into the house and observe? And this family had let in police. They had let in all these scientists. They'd let in everyone. But they wouldn't let in Milburn Christopher. And that's the interesting part. And then when the police ask the family, well, will you all take polygraphs? The family also turned that down too. So I'd say those are two fairly telling clues when you don't allow the master of sleight of hand to observe the situation. And Milburn Christopher was able to replicate a lot of this poltergeist activity, and he even showed the parapsychologist. Like, he would just be in the office talking to them, and tops would start popping off bottles and such. So he's showing them, like, it's not that hard, I can do it as well. So you can read more about that in Behind the Horror. The point is, whether you choose to believe the paranormal explanations or you want to run with the skeptical explanations, but I've got both in there, and how they relate to the movies and inspired them.
Absolutely. And you talk in this is of story I'm not so familiar with, at least in its connection to a movie. And you write about the town that dreaded sundown, and very interesting about its connection to, not only is it about a movie, or at least it takes part at a drive-in theater, but tell us a little bit about the inspiration for this, The Town That Dreaded Sundown, 1976.
Yeah, so the town that dreaded sundown, I honestly think is a fairly awful movie, but it was one of the first slasher films. And at the time, people did find it genuinely scary. And it is probably the film that mirrors the inspiring story the closest, although it is
Right.
certainly far enough away that you can say that it inspired it. It's nowhere near a true account of events. So it's not like Fincher's Zodiac, for instance, right? I would not
Right.
do something like that. So then you're basically just telling the story. But what it was, now that I mentioned Zodiac, because we're in the realm of Lover's Lanes here and men wearing masks, it's Texarkana, which is actually exists in two states. I believe there's a Texas part of it and there's an Arkansas part of it. And it gets the name Texarkana because it's right on the border of Texas, Arkansas, and Louisiana. And so this is in about 1945, 1946, around there. And there are couples, some of them are in their 20s, some of them are teenagers, and they're going out on dates, to lovers' lanes and such. And the first time this happens, this couple, they go out to a movie with the brother, and I think it was the friend and his girlfriend. It's sort of like a double date. They go to a movie, and then after that, they drop off his brother and the brother's girlfriend at home, and then they go out to a lover's lane, this couple. And while they're in the car and, presumably in the middle of making out or about to or something like that, there is this masked gunman that shows up and orders them out of the car. And he basically, once they're out of the car, he pistol whips the male unconscious, and the female sees this happening and gets terrified, and she starts running down the road, and she passes a car on the way, and that's an important clue. And he manages to catch up to her, and then he strikes her a number of times, and then he sexually violates her with the barrel, and then he goes back to beating up on the guy. And in the meantime, she manages to continue on down the road, and she gets to a farmhouse and she knocks on the door and gets help. As she's waiting for someone to answer the door, she sees another vehicle drive by, which very well may have been the vehicle that the attacker used, although it doesn't match the description of the vehicle that she passed. Anyways, police come to the scene. Both survive in this first instance, although they're severely traumatized, physically and psychologically. The young lady moves out of the town. I think she goes to Oklahoma and just goes to stay with relatives there. The young man remains in the town, but it takes him years to get over the injuries he has sustained. And so this continues. There are two more couples that go through this over the next few months, weeks even. And these ones are not allowed to go. They are killed. And what I found in researching this is something that has been kept from the public for a while, and that is that the females were raped. And when this story has been told elsewhere, that's not included. But that's a fact. And then they seem to have redressed themselves and then been shot to death. So you've got this basically masked attacker of couples at lovers' lanes who probably shoots the man outright and then rapes the woman at gunpoint, gets herself to redress herself, and then shoots her. And people will just find the cars. In the first instance, they find the car with the bodies in it the next day. And then the next instance, the bodies are in two separate places. And by this time, they bring in the Texas Rangers. And there's this one particular Texas Ranger. He's got a reputation of, you know, he's an expert tracker with all these skills. And he always gets his man. And there's the big media attention when he comes to town, and he's always making these announcements in the newspapers about, you know, leads on the killer and how he's going to find him. In truth, he's not doing much of anything. He's not getting anywhere close. And the last attack, and this is disputed because it might not be the same guy, but it is usually included in the canon, is there's a man just sitting in his home, and he's watching the television. His wife is lying in bed, and this is like a farmhouse. And she hears a noise, I believe, and gets up to see what it is. And she goes out into the living room and sees that her husband has been shot dead through the window, and he's still sitting in the chair watching TV. And at that point, she sees this masked man outside the window and realizes that she's next. And so he starts to chase her, and she manages to get away, and she gets to the nearest farmhouse, and they take her to the hospital.
Right.
And then the reign of terror seems to end. Now, in the film, it's not portrayed like that. The cops get a lot closer. There are like shootouts and the car chases and such. The reality is they never really got close to this guy, and they have a suspect who they believe may have done it, but they never proved it. And the killings did stop, you know, and I think one of the big questions beyond who actually did this was that last killing actually part of the series? And what I note in Behind the Horror is that the guy who was shot in his farmhouse while watching TV was having an affair with a married woman whose husband had just come back from overseas. So that may have been lumped in there as being, you know, the final victim of the Texarkana Moonlight murderer, when in reality it was a jealous husband who shot the guy who was screwing his wife through the window. So, yeah, there's, you know, a hell of a lot more detail, obviously, in the book, but that's the meat of it. And what I would say is just most intriguing to me about that, it's not just the time and, you know, the setting. It has a vibe to it, an atmosphere when you're reading about it. It transports you back to a much more innocent time. But he was like the prototypical masked killer. And there's so much attention on, like, the Zodiac, right? You know, he wears this weird hood, and he attacks people at Lover's Lanes. But this guy was doing it 22 years before that. And so there's two ways to look at that. The Zodiac presumably knew about that guy. Or, and I don't think this is true, but it's fun to speculate, is it the same guy?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't think so at all.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
So that inspires the town that dreaded sundown, which, by the way, you can watch on YouTube right now. And no offense if you like it. I thought it was the worst movie I wrote about in the book.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get to ones. We have to just briefly summarize the other stories that you cover in this, the movies and their inspiration. The Amityville Horror from 1979, The Haunting of 112 Ocean Avenue. You mentioned Poltergeist from 1982, based on the Seaford Poltergeist. You say that likely some shenanigans going on there. Nightmare on Elm Street, 1984. And I thought this was odd, the sudden unexplained nocturnal death syndrome as an inspiration. I thought that was fascinating. And you cover The Serpent and the Rainbow, a movie I saw many years ago, was and The Strange Tale of Claire Vias Narcisse, and that incredible tale behind that, which I thought that I had not read anything about that in terms of the real story behind that. So you also talk
the
about
real
The Silence
story
of the
is
Lambs.
Actually better than the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
The film is good, too. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yes. Silence of the Lambs was... sorry, go ahead, Dan.
No, go ahead. Talk about The Silence of the Lambs, because that particularly was inspired by many, very much like the Weimar Germany cases. There was much inspiration for The Silence of the Lambs in terms of story.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. I was just about to make that comparison. It was Thomas Harris and, you know... I guess it was Jonathan Demme and the screenwriters. They really studied up on their golden age serial killers, to use that term. And so even the premise of The Silence of the Lambs has some root in reality. And that's that law enforcement goes to a notorious serial killer to get his insight into finding another serial killer who's at large. And this is the story of Bob Keppel and Dave Reichert, who was investigating, they're both investigating the Green River killings, going to Ted Bundy's cell in Florida's death row and saying, Ted, you know, this is your neck of the woods. And it really is, because I've been there physically. It's amazing how close Bundy and Ridgway's crimes were. And saying, so Ted, like, can you help us find this guy? And Bob Keppel wrote a book about this called The River Man. And he said, to be honest with you, I didn't think Ted would have any insight. I was using this as a trick to try and get him to talk about some of his own crimes. What I find compelling about that is if you actually look into The River Man, Bundy did give them some good ideas that they could have acted upon. So he wasn't totally useless. And so that frames the Hannibal Lecter advising Clarice Starring on how to catch Buffalo Bill, who famously skins his humps, as they say. They call him Buffalo Bill for like skinning buffaloes. And that's because he's making the bodies that they're finding in rivers. They all have big patches of skin missing from them. They're all obese young women. And this, of course, goes back to Ed Gein, who makes the woman suit, right? And so not only does Ed Gein inspire Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs, but he inspires Leatherface with his dead skin mask in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And in some ways, Norman Bates in Psycho, that's another chapter of the book. But to get back to Silence of the Lambs, the character of Buffalo Bill, a lot of people know about the Ed Gein thing. They're like, oh, yeah, it's inspired by Ed Gein. What they don't know is that there are aspects of many other serial killers in the Buffalo Bill characters. So if we look at how he apprehends his victims, if you recall that classic scene from Silence of the Lambs where I think it's the congresswoman or the senator's daughter is coming back from, she's driving home to her apartment at night, and there's a guy who's struggling to get a piece of furniture inside his van, and he keeps dropping it, and he's making a bit of a show. And she feels guilty, and, Mister, can I help you? Oh, would you? So kind of you. And then he gets her into the van and knocks her unconscious. That's how he gets control over her. That's classic Ted Bundy.
Sure.
That is how Ted Bundy got at least most of his Washington victims when he was sort of at the height of his success in Washington. So that first approach stage of the MO is based on Bundy. But then as far as how he keeps them, that was inspired by Gary Heidnik, who ran the infamous House of Horrors in Philadelphia, where he kept, I think it was 5 or 6, young black women naked in a pit in his basement, and he would torture them. And it's all in the book, but it's a pretty horrific case you know, torture, murder. Mm-hmm. And the whole point is with Buffalo Bill, he keeps his victims in the pit. That's basically the connection to Heidnik. When they read about Thomas Harris read about the Heidnik case, he said, okay, we'll put that in there. And then how Buffalo Bill disposes of his victims is he dumps them in rivers. And sure. that, of course, harkens back to Gary, well, at the time they didn't know it was Gary Ridgway, the still then uncaught Green River Killer. But also, you can put in Jerry Brudos in there. Jerry Brudos, everyone's seen Mindhunter now, so I don't think I need to expand on him too much. He's the foot fetish guy, the guy who covets the shoes. And the thing about Jerry Brudos that isn't in Mindhunter, I don't think, which is pretty tremendous, is Brudos would put his victims in the river, but he would carry them out there from his car, and he would also carry, like, car engines and transmissions, with like, things that you would think that, you know, no single man would be able to carry. He was that strong that he would do that. And some of Buffalo Bill's earliest victims are attached to similarly heavy objects. Brudos was also transvestic fetish, so a bit of Jerry Brudos bled into that character too. And then finally, once again, Mindhunter, you have Ed Kemper, right? And this is more in the background story. It's not so much in the film, but it is in the novel. And of course, the person portraying Buffalo Bill in the film would have known this is the backstory of his character, is that he killed his grandparents and was committed to a psychiatric institution. Well, who did that? Ed Kemper. So just in that one character, Buffalo Bill, you have that many serial killers. And I mean, we can do Hannibal Lecter too if you want, or we can leave that a bit of a mystery for people who might want to read the book, but there's killers that inspired Hannibal Lecter that you've never even heard of, and the foremost one you definitely haven't heard of.
Dr. Trevino.
Don't give it away. Don't give it on the internet. Go ahead.
You also the Monster of Florence is also an influence, and also you talk about Andre Ciccatillo as an influence as well. So it's got everybody and covering every single thing that we would seem as a unique characteristic among serial killers and infamous killers. You continue with Scream in 1996, and that inspired by the murder of Janet Christman and the crimes of the Gainesville Ripper. And we've talked on this program about the Gainesville Ripper a little bit. You also have the Mothman Prophecies, 2002. The Mothman.
Yeah, that was the
Point Pleasant.
The right. Yeah. That was surreal. That's just, I was writing that, and I was just in a weird head, like a weird good headspace writing that. If you don't know the story of the Mothman and Indrid Cold and all the things that happened in Point Pleasant, West Virginia between 1966 and 67, which actually results in like a major disaster in which a bridge collapses amidst all this, and then stories of men in black showing up and everything, things that didn't even make it into the movie. This is a case of where this story is actually far better than the film. And writing it felt like being on acid. I'll just put it that way. It was a surreal experience to write it.
You also cover something that we've spoken about on this program before, and I think some people are familiar with this incredible movie, Wolf Creek from 2005, and the incredible crimes of Ivan Milat and the murder of Peter Falconio. You also, we just referenced it a little bit, or mentioned it in the introduction, The Conjuring, 2013, films that I'm not familiar with, Annabelle, 2014, and The Conjuring 2, 2016. Again, you talked about the Mothman Prophecies, like you're on acid. How about The Conjuring 2? Tell us about a little bit about that.
Not the same, although interesting. Why the Mothman feels hallucinatory is because it's not paranormal in the conventional sense. So it's right. not demons or ghosts. Mm-hmm. It's something that we can't explain. Something interdimensional, you know, energies and manifestations, but not in a Judeo-Christian framework. The Conjuring films and Annabelle are all based on the case files of Ed and Lorraine Warren, who were, of course, Ed was a demonologist, and I think Lorraine said she was some sort of psychic, like a clairvoyant or whatever. And they were also involved, apparently, in the Amityville, though that never actually made it into the movie. Actually, The Conjuring 2 starts with the house in the Amityville Horror, so that appears in actually both films. So, yeah, those films are decent. I mean, they're good little horror films. Some people like them more than me. I thought number two was the better of the two, but essentially, yeah, the first one, the Conjuring one, is about the Perron family who move into a house, a big old country home in New England, and they find out that it's haunted by a woman called Bathsheba Sherman, who was believed to be a witch, and that the house is full of all kinds of spirits. And so there's the story of that is told in the film, but I actually tell you the story that came from the family themselves and the involvement of Ed and Lorraine Warren. I should say that I also looked into anything paranormal with a skeptical eye, and I always found I always found things that were suspicious, and that one's suspicious. The Conjuring 2, that, to my mind, was a better movie. That's set in Enfield, North London. And that was a big case at the time. That was all in the British newspapers. This wasn't something that someone wrote a book about later. This was like an ongoing thing where police were showing up at the house, and there's items flying all over the place, and the police can't explain it, and they've got, you know, once again, parapsychologists and involved in there, and everyone trying to figure out what's going on, and the possession of this little girl and potentially her sister. And so, yeah, Ed and Lorraine Warren, in reality, in the film, it depicts them as central to it. In reality, they just kind of popped in, and, you know, I don't think they were there longer than a couple days, and it was much less dramatic. I think the final prognosis on the Enfield Poltergeist is that, once again, we have a mischievous little child who has some issues and was able to fool a lot of adults. And wow. I think people struggle with that explanation because we think of children as, like, I mean, it's bad enough to be fooled by another adult into believing that something supernatural is going on, but how can a kid pull it off? But they did catch this little girl. Some of the paranormal investigators, the parapsychologists, they did catch this little girl setting things up. So she maintains to this day that she didn't, and she's, you know, still makes little public appearances every once in a while. But now I guess it comes down to your degree of belief. I tend towards skepticism. And so, yeah, I detail both of those stories and the investigations into them and all of the players involved in Behind the Horror, yeah.
Finally, you have you've discussed The Witch from 2015 and The Lighthouse from 2019. And the inspiration for The Witch is the Salem Witch Trials of 1692.
Yes.
And also for The Lighthouse, the Smalls Lighthouse Tragedy. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this book, Behind the Horror, True Stories and Inspired Horror Movies. Also, you've been on this program a couple times with your books, Cold North Killers mm-hmm. and Rampage. Tell a little bit about how they might take a look at your work And do you have a website? And also about your podcast, Murder Was the Case.
Right, yeah. Well, there's so much now, Dan, since we last talked. That, and, you know, I apologize for not being more in touch. I've just been so busy. I got my PhD. I don't know if I've ever talked to you about that.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, so there is my 2012 book, Cold North Killers, Canadian Serial Murder, which covers 60 cases of serial murder in Canada, and you can get that on Amazon, as you can also get my 2013 book, Rampage Canadian Mass Murder and Spree Killing, on Amazon, and that's about the same subject, fewer cases, but I think well-written. I was a little wiser at that point, and then I have some academic books, but, you know, if you are really into criminal psychology, yes, they're expensive, but they might be worth picking up. I wrote Homicide, a Forensic Psychology Casebook, and you can learn everything that you can't learn anywhere else about necrophilic and sexually sadistic offenders in there, about what psychopathic violence is like. And then I actually have a book which focuses on the topic of necrophilia itself, understanding necrophilia, if you really want to go down into the abyss. Yeah, we go there. And I say we because I collaborated with other people on that. And then after that, there's the crime book, which was a coffee table book that I helped author. I wrote a good 40% of that. That's from the same publisher as Behind the Horror, DK Books, which is a Penguin imprint. So you know it's high-quality stuff. You don't get a contract with Penguin unless you're a good writer. And the crime book, yeah, has got everything from famous heists to white collar crime to serial killings to strange cult like behavior. It would make a terrific Christmas present. And so there's that one. And there's Behind the Horror, which we just discussed, and you can get that on Amazon. And I've got to tell you, Dan, I've got one coming out in February, once again, with DK Books. It's all written. And this was the one I actually had the most fun writing. And if you want to talk about the feeling like you're on psychotropic drugs while you're writing it, this is Conspiracies Uncovered. And I didn't do a hack job on it. I really delved into it, and I got about, I don't know how many made the final cut, but I got about 15 really compelling conspiracies into that book, conspiracy theories. Starting with Operation Grey Wolf, you know, did Hitler actually make it out of Germany and live in Argentina? And ending with the COVID-19, like what all the conspiracy theories surrounding that. And that was an interesting conversation with the publisher, because I think when we thought of doing that chapter, we were like, well, that's going to be resolved and I'll be able to have some established truth, so we can say what the conspiracy theories really are. And at some point we had to have the conversation, it seems like the truth is getting farther and farther away with this one. Which part is the conspiracy theory? Yeah, exactly. So I also got some stuff on Jeffrey Epstein in there and his involvement with intelligence. So there's going to be some good stuff in that one. Yeah, excited for that to come out.
Absolutely.
That's my. Those are my writings, Dan. And as you mentioned, I have a podcast, Murder Was the Case, and it appeals to a very, I would say, niche audience. But if you like uncensored, but not for the sake of being tasteless, but for the sake of getting to the truth and really understanding crime, and particularly aberrant sex homicides and the like at, you know, the highest level, you can go to that. I talked to all, I think I've talked to all of the experts now, but I also teach little seminars myself. And so if that sounds like your cup of tea, Murder Was the Case podcast, please check that out. It's an ongoing thing. I'm really, really proud of what I do with that. And I've got to say, Dan, you know, since we last talked, there's been this big boom in and all these true crime podcasts, which I know you've noticed. There's no way you didn't, right?
Right.
But you're the original as far as I'm concerned. Now, you might dispute that. You might know something that I don't. You might not think of yourself as a podcast. You know, it might be a radio show. But I just want to remind everyone, before Serial and before all these podcasts that you're addicted to, it was always Dan Zupansky. You were the guy I knew that was doing this going all the way back to 2012 with my first book. So I consider you the grandmaster, Dan.
Well, thank you so much. That's a great honor hearing from you and those kind words. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Behind the Horror, true stories that inspired horror movies. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. Have a great evening, Dr. Lee Meller.
Yep. See you, Dan.
Good night.
Good night.